I just learned during the break there that actually I got knocked off too. So no wonder Amity Schles was confused. She's talking from Hawaii and suddenly I go on my end, or at least I don't know. We can't quite figure out what's happened, but my end, I was still linked up. I had 40 seconds here, and I thought I was killing while they were getting Amity Schles back on. And I just want to tell you, those were 40 seconds of scintillating off the top of my head radio. I wish somebody had actually heard them, but apparently not. But we'll get back to your questions and comments for Amity Schles. We'll link you up with her next on Coast to Coast AM. Are you the forgotten man? At least, is that how you feel these days? We'll talk more about this great book about the Depression next on Coast to Coast AM. Let's rack up a bunch of calls for Amity Schles, The Forgotten Man, and we'll talk a little bit more about World War II in just a second as that plays into the end of the Depression. But first, Ramon is in Davenport, Iowa on Coast to Coast AM. Or do you say
Yeah.
Raymond?
It's Ramon.
Okay, good.
Aloha from Davenport. Hey, my question is for you, during your studies, what did you find from the chain gang era? Because I had to do a study back in high school, and it seemed to me that the local municipalities used the, homeless hobos, or the hobos that were out looking for work, and used them for cheap labor, by saying that they were vagrant because they didn't even have
Sure.
a penny in their pocket.
Yeah, that's an interesting, particularly in the South, that was done, I think. But thanks
Yep.
for Ramon. Go ahead. You have a thought on that, Amity?
Oh, well, yes. This was that era, and of course, much of it was before. You have right up in the 19th century. You have 1800s chain gangs, right? From those images. So I don't know much about that. I'm sorry to say. I was in Iowa last week, so I'm glad to hear from you, but I don't know so much about that, so I'm not going to just
Well,
BS.
I'll tell you a little bit about it. I think he's right on, although I think, as you say, it happens before and then after. But there was a period where municipalities were funding themselves by arresting anybody who had no visible means of support. So if you were passing through town, but you had no money in your pocket, or you were waiting too long at the train station or whatever, you could be arrested for vagrancy, or suspicions of various sorts. And then, in order to pay off your fine, you went into a kind of indentured servitude, and the counties or the municipalities would rent you out to pay off your fine. And it became this sort of informal, sudden slavery. And there are a couple of books written about it, and it's fascinating before the system really breaks down. But I mean, some places got away with that for literally for 10, 20 years of people that were locked into these debts that they could never pay back because, as Ramon said, they didn't even have a penny in their pocket, and that was enough to get them charged. And it sounds crazy, but it happened, particularly in the South. I read a book on that once. It was great. West of the Rockies, Thomas is in Colorado on Coast to Coast AM. Thomas?
Hi, thanks for having me on. I wanted to ask about with the recent World Bank break-ins and being hacked in, and a lot of vulnerable information being given to the vulnerabilities of worldwide markets. And I noticed the KSE, the Karachi Stock Exchange in Pakistan, particularly the Morbas, which are the Islamic law banks, have gone up approximately 20% since the world markets have crashed. Is there a possibility of economic terrorism involved with some of these market crashes, or is
That's a
that just...
really interesting idea. Amity, where are you with that?
Well, I just want to clarify for the listeners, the question is whether the World Bank is confronting a siege, and that people are hacking in, that their data are being raided by outsiders. A lot of Fox has been reporting that, for example. That's certainly a possible component. I don't know about Sharia law or that, but it's certainly a possible component because these entities, the mortgage-backed securities, and so on, were underregulated. It's always possible for someone to fool with balance sheets and books, and we may find some of that, yes.
And interesting on who is benefiting during these times and whether, like you mentioned earlier, with the Mormons, that there was easier, there was a kind of theocratic leadership in Utah that allowed for there to be less panic and therefore maybe perhaps fewer problems during the Depression than, you know, other places. And I wonder whether that might be true in Muslim countries where somehow there might be a way of tying people together or keeping things holding on because everybody's falls into the same religious tent. Any thought on that?
Well, that's not my area. There's a scholar, Frank Gaffney, for example, who's worked on the financial terror and Sharia law and also Muslim communities. So it's just not at all my area, I want to say.
Okay. You're going to find that when we're doing open lines here with questions for you, you're going to find a lot of people who have really distinct pattern, things they're really interested in, and they're going to connect it to us here in one way or another, and we'll see whether any of them stick.
Well,
Kevin,
it's accurate that there is something mysterious about the current collapse, and we haven't found all the causes. We found some proximate causes. Moral hazard at Fannie Mae, these Fannie and Freddie got too big and no one stopped them. There are parts of America that are not a conspiracy theory, and that when you impose a conspiracy theory on them, you are exaggerating, but there are other parts where there was significant conspiracy, or at the very least thuggish behavior, like the Sopranos, maybe not the deaths, but otherwise a thuggish America, and Fannie and Freddie were two of those.
Right.
Where there was real intimidation of politicians and the media, where people paused, where there was real buying of people legally or illegally. That was one corner of the United States where a lot of stuff that you would see in movies happened.
We have Kevin in St. Paul on Coast to Coast AM for Amity Schlaes. Kevin?
Hey, guys. It's interesting you mentioned conspiracy theories because I hope I don't get put in that little box. But I do have a tremendous distrust of government regulation of the economy. I think there are absolutely great motivations for government to do things that benefit particular groups and organizations at the highest levels and oftentimes at the expense of sort of ordinary folks trying to live ordinary lives. And by distorting the economy, it shifts all of that power, if you will, to the top. And I guess what's interesting to me is that it shifted up to the national government in the last Depression. And my feeling now is that we're seeing a shift of much of our national sovereignty from our national government and now actually shifting it up to an international organization, which is one further step, in my opinion, very much in the wrong direction. So I guess my question is, do you see it that way, or am I simply overstating the case, and is there a place for national and, God forbid, international organizations coming in and manipulating portions of our economy? And is Bush, now that he's going into this upcoming meeting and talking about, quote-unquote, modernizing...
There's a lot here already, Kevin. You got a lot in that question, so let's give Amity a chance to jump in there. Go ahead.
Well, that is an accurate assessment of what happened in the 30s. The power went to Washington. You can mark it by a year. Before 1936, the states and local governments were a bigger share of the economy than the federal government. In 1936, it flipped. 37 had a little drawback, but ever after that, the federal government was bigger. It's documented. You can look in Tax Foundation or elsewhere. You'll see the charts. And it was troubling because a lot of the ability to recover itself, to manage its problems of the country on a local level, was taken away. And the same thing can happen in international, at the international level. You certainly see it in Europe, where they've condensed, consolidated power at the EU level, and they have a democratic deficit. Way down there, people don't get enough say, and as a result, at many points, they don't make the right decisions. I am not so much concerned by Bush and international meetings, but I am concerned by the Treasury bailout, because it's very discretionary. Basically, it's $700 billion, and you give it to us, and we'll fix it from this office. And there was always one healthy thing about the United States, that New York was one kind of capital, the financial capital, and Washington was the political capital. What this bailout does, especially the discretionary aspect, is pull power, pull banks to Washington so that it's all in one place. And I wrote a column about that in the Bloomberg, where I write, and also it appeared, I think, in the New York Post. So we may see the death or the bleeding of New York. And that's, even if you don't like New York, that's not good to have one power center instead of two. We'll certainly see, no matter what, a second K Street, a second row of lobbyists there in Washington, just about this one thing, the $700 billion package, because it really does matter who you know at Goldman Sachs, what happens to your bank, or who you know at the Treasury. And that's not a good way for America to work. It should be about prices and fairness, and it doesn't matter who you are. And it's a very deal-oriented rescue, and the construct of it, and that is troubling.
Let's get Heath in Virginia. I don't know if he's in the real Virginia or the not real part of Virginia, but Heath, you're on Coast to Coast AM for Amity Schlaes.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. But following up to what you were just talking about, yeah, this will be the second occasion that that we have been led on a certain course by pretext, first being the war in Iraq, and now this sudden bailout.
I don't see them as parallel. You may, but I don't. I think the war, it's another discussion, another conversation, the war in Iraq. This is just sheer panic, and I think they panicked their way to a non-good solution that's getting somewhat better because of the way they're structuring it, but what I said before to the previous caller still holds. That's just the way government is. You know, Democrats will do it, Republicans will do it. They react to crises by consolidating power. The economic theory that explains all this best for me is public choice theory, right at George Mason. It says, you know what, it's all like a battle of crustaceans. It's no more complex than that. When you have two or three lobsters battling it out, the government and the private sector are both crustaceans, and they both want to survive, and they're brutal about the way they do it, and they'll eat anything. You do see government tend to want to consolidate power when something bad happens. It's a rare executive who won't do it. Doesn't matter if it's Bush. I think the Democrats would have acted identically.
But are we really getting to the crux of the problem, or are we just throwing money at it without really a thorough understanding of what is going on?
Well, I kind of am concerned about it, too. I do agree that probably you should throw some liquidity at a credit crunch where the spreads, the data look like they did. The way they did it was not the optimal way, and I believe, and many of us have argued, that if you can say crisis, and throw money in reform later, but there ought to be some clear, transparent reform at the same time, not just all this power sent to the government. If you want to say what is the problem that they're not getting at, they should get rid of Fannie and Freddie. There should be no Fannie and Freddie. They should reconsider whether they're going to have Glass-Steagall. Maybe little banks where people get their mortgages should not be attached to pension funds in Iceland if we all can't handle it.
Right.
So, but then that reconsideration is failing to happen, alas.
I know this is crazy, so just let me give you that preface. I'm not expecting this to be taken too seriously, but I've yet to get an actual answer on why. It's so crazy to think that you could have just given $1 million to every tax-paying citizen of the United States. Just giving them, if we had all this money for liquidity, why couldn't you flood the market, if you will, with liquidity from the bottom up instead of the top down?
Well, it's because when banks lend, they have their reserves, and they have reserve requirements, and they lend out a multiple of that. That's how money is created. Banks aren't like people. People can use money, and they can spend money. They get the $1 million. They could buy a house. They could have a fortune. They could have a happy life. it would be a great thing, but they can't create as much growth as a bank can because a bank will take that and lend a lot more. Is it just for the basis? That's a simple way to put it. A bank is a special multiplier, and it really does create a lot of growth, and maybe it will loan, you know, multiples of that, millions and millions off that little amount that it gets. So there's an efficiency argument there.
Well, okay, but why couldn't it trickle up, so to speak, where people would pay off of the, they would pay off their home loans, right? And that that money then would then go to the bank, and that's what would create the liquidity for the banks.
And that, oh, that would be way too slow, for one thing. Given where we were, we didn't want all these banks to fail, probably. But I take your point that there's a democratic deficit here, too, and I agree with that.
Well, I don't know that I'm even making that cogent a point. Just, it's something I keep getting in emails.
Well, plus,
and I keep...
if you pay off your loan, the money's going back into the bank. And I'm not an economist. I'm a journalist who wrote an economic book and is fascinated with economic history and writes about it. But you put the money back in the bank, that's not good. The money should go out of the bank in order to combat deflation, which is what they're scared of.
All right. Tony is in Ohio on Coast to Coast AM, and he's talking with Amity Schlaes, author of The Forgotten Man. Go ahead, Tony.
Hello, Amity. Thank you for taking my telephone call. And you, Ian, thank you very much for putting me through. Now, my question is about men from the past. You might know him in history. His name is Frederick Delano. I believe he was the uncle of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Now, he was a big, like, railroad man slash, merchant banker, investment man. Now, from what I hear, he was instrumental in signing of the Federal Reserve Act. And I was wondering, like, you know, we have this one guy, the uncle, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, who was, you know, the trust buster. Then we get, you know, the nephew in there, and, I mean, he's all about, you know, like, bigger. I have this image of... you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, not as being the great savior, but as being, a little pull of the New World Order and the bankers.
Am I right
about that?
Amity?
I don't think he thought, I don't know enough about the Roosevelt papers to know about the relationship between Frederick Adrian Delano, the uncle, and Franklin. Frederick, Federal Reserve, yes. Franklin Roosevelt didn't really like monetary. He didn't get it. He was a Navy person, not a banking person. It were coins he played with as a child, but he'd never spent that much time in the business world. He was a lawyer, Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and he didn't really get it, so to see too big a connection there, I think, would be exaggerating. What he did have was the sense that he ought to control it, but he had the same sense for utilities and a lot of non-monetary things as well. This, I should run this feeling of Franklin, that was real. And you're right that in the New Deal period, stuff happened to money that had never happened. Well, rarely happened before. For example, if you had a gold clause in a contract that said, to make yourself feel confident, I'll take it in money in this contract or I'll take it in ounces, and I get to pick at the time that you pay me, that was your own inflation hedge. They were very common, and they were in contracts with governments as well, bonds. Roosevelt abrogated this clause and said it's not valid even if it's between two private people. That paying of ounces is just not on. It's going to be in the dollars, and I will say what a dollar is. That was very extreme, and there's adjudication about that to this day, about whether is it really okay. In the end, Congress quasi-reversed it, and now people are going back and saying, I want my old gold contract honored from many, many decades ago. I want my ounces.
Right.
And so he didn't care about that. I got to hang on.
Sorry, we're coming right up against a hard break. We'll be back. Amity Schlaes next on Coast to Coast AM. Well, actually, I went and I tracked down that book that I was talking about last half hour, Ramon from Davenport had mentioned it, not the book per se, but the subject of people that had been captured during the era that was leading up to it, and before and after the stock market crash, people who had been essentially sold into slavery. And that there was no way to fight this. And the book that I was referring to is actually one of the most disturbing books I've ever read. It's called Lay This Body Down, The 1921 Murders of 11 Plantation Slaves. It was written by an Atlanta Journal-Constitution writer named Gregory Freeman. And it's astounding to think that this was going on in the 20s and that it went on in pockets. Well into the 30s, where people could be arrested for vagrancy, standing at a train station, but didn't have, quote, you know, means of support, and then put in this indefinite system of their, you know, the money that was spent to feed them was used to pile on top of a fine, which they couldn't afford to pay because they knew they didn't have any money in the first place. And they couldn't write anybody. They weren't allowed to contact anybody. There was no way to get out of it. And this book is about the guy that is a plantation owner that that created this own slavery system along with the help of some local municipalities. So I don't know. It's very interesting. Lay This Body Down. I checked. It's still available on Amazon. It's worth it. And it just it's spooky. It's right out of John Wayne Gacy or Ed Gein. I mean, the guy was essentially a serial killer. And with a unique pipeline of victims. But that just goes to show you, so much of history is so fascinating when you give it a fresh look, like Amity Schles did with The Forgotten Man, our last round of calls for her from you next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. All right, Amity Schles for just a few more minutes more, and then we'll let her get back to her family. But thank you in advance for all this time that you've given us in helping us understand better both the era of the Depression and how we can learn from the before and after in order to make sure that whatever is happening now be as brief as possible. EJ is in Wisconsin on Coast to Coast AM for Amity Schles. EJ?
Oh, yeah, and thank you for taking my call. Amity, you had made a comment earlier about we know that fascism and communism, or I should say socialism, were bad because of how many people were killed underneath them. But then if you look at, you know, I wonder, what do you feel then that we're better than them? Because look at how many Indians were murdered, all the slaves, the union laborers, the union organizers back in the teens and early 1900s that were murdered for trying to get us our labor rights as the 40-hour work week, the minimum wage. And I'm questioning what.
Well, let's let her respond. Go ahead. Go ahead. I mean, it's a decent question.
It's a decent question. I think there's no comparison to the evil of the Soviet Union or communist China with the United States. There are terrible things that have happened in the United States. There's been racism. There's been the way we treated the Native Americans, the Indians. There's been labor trouble. It's nothing like those places. There's no possibility of relativizing them.
Well, I would disagree, since there are complete and total tribes that do not exist any longer whatsoever, and that we try to force. I mean, that's a complete and total genocide of not just one group, but multiple groups. Plus, if you look at how we have funded people such as Hitler, and we have done things in South America, Asia, and Middle East, I mean, we have done a lot of horrid things.
I appreciate the question, and I agree that we have done a lot of hard things, that U.S. foreign policy is in many decades appallingly bad, but it is nothing like the planned murder on the larger scale. And we all are very, very concerned about Native Americans. You can even see it. It's close to genocide. I still don't think it's comparable, and the magnitudes of the murders suggest that that's accurate.
I'll go along with that to a large extent, except to say that let's not forget there were like the Trail of Tears, and Andrew Jackson's general predisposition toward Native American issues is let them die. I mean, he couldn't have cared less, and created the circumstances where they were bound to die, if not suffer a slow, agonizing death and, you know, live on in abject poverty. But it's interesting comparison about the thing about Hitler, though. That is right around this time when many American industrialists, many American financiers do get involved in financing Hitler toward the tail end of our American Depression. Does that intersect with your work at all? I mean,
I haven't looked for a long time at Germany. I did write a book about Germany. My impression of Germany is that it's a my not only my impression, but my research suggests that it's a bit of a myth that even German big business was so very much for Hitler. I commend, therefore, the books of Henry Ashby Turner in that regard and a few others. U.S. business, did they go for Hitler sometimes all the time? They were pragmatic. Were they wrong? Totally. Hjalmar Schacht was a genius. He was a German central banker. He was a central banker. They had a lot of respect for him. So what? He was a Nazi. They overlooked that when he, you know, his Nazi period. Does that answer the question?
I don't know that there is an answer, but I think there's an interest. It's an interesting period.
What came across the page for me researching the period was the incredible controversy about recognizing the Soviet Union. And we think, well, of course, right, America recognizes, you know, sovereign states. We don't question their politics. There was huge controversy because the Soviet Union suppressed religion. And the churches in the United States said it is uncivilized to recognize this young Soviet Union because they are bad, ungodly people. And when Roosevelt met with Maxim Lifanov, he said, you know, Max, your father and your mother, they went to church. What about respecting that? So it was a concern that he had to raise it pro forma. And FDR did recognize the Soviet Union, as the listeners do know, and I would argue, looking at it, it was pretty problematic because it gave Stalin a license to do even worse stuff than he was already doing.
Yeah.
We gave him that fig leaf of respectability. And I had never thought about that. And it's certainly not something that we learn in school, that we shouldn't have recognized the Soviet Union, but maybe we shouldn't have.
Yeah, but a lot of the progressives, even of the era, didn't recognize the Soviet Union. Even that trip that you mentioned, didn't Lewis resist recognizing the Soviet Union or meeting with certain people? Am I wrong on that?
Oh, absolutely. The regular Union people were appalled by the Soviet Union and were appalled that they would be associated with that. They were for honest socialism. The Soviet Union was a bunch of thugs, the Bolsheviks. Right. And they said, that's not our socialism. And in fact, the union players in my book who go to the Soviet Union on this famous 1927 trip were low-down guys. The high guys wouldn't go. Yeah. So they were kind of dissing the union establishment by even going over to the Soviet Union. One was James Hudson Maurer, who ran for president at one point with the socialists. But a lot of the unions were no. And you see that later post-war. I mean, there were unions who worked with Solidarity in the United States when Solidarity was at a turning point. Those unions did not respect the Polish regime, the martial law. They were on the side of freedom. So just because you're with a union doesn't mean you're always for the bad communists, to oversimplify.
Gerald is in Canada on the international line for Amity Schlaes on Coast to Coast AM. Gerald?
Good morning. My question is about the March the 9th, 1933 Emergency War Powers Act that is still in power. It reclassified Americans as enemies of the United States, classified them as chattel property, and
reclassified who as enemies of the United States?
If you read the document, it's written in about eighth grade language, which is excellent. The Emergency War Powers Act passed March the 9th, 1933, by Franklin Delano Roosevelt. It's a key part of the Roosevelt administration. It redefined America. And you can plainly read in the document, it's still enacted. And now, when you fast forward to our society today, the cashless fractional reserve system created by Woodrow Wilson in 1913, this Federal Reserve system owned by private bankers out of England, and they loan us our money. Now, JFK tried to stop it, in 1963 when he ordered the Treasury to print United States notes. But as you know, his life was ended, and LBJ immediately told him to start canceling that money. My question,
before we race forward, yeah, let's get to the question. What was you want Amity's reaction to the War Powers Act?
Correct.
Okay, go ahead, Amity.
Well, in the book, what I talk about is things like this are significant. I can't remember how much I address this, if at all, but what Roosevelt did was say, we're on war footing, and therefore I have double authority. And there was a whole bunch of legislation, a whole bunch of rhetoric that, give me the power, it's a war.
Correct.
It's an economic war, and that was problematic, yes. It did hurt the economy. I actually don't have a lot of trouble with the bank holiday. I think it was necessary, and it was fast. It wasn't much different from what anyone else would have done. But when you say we're emergency now, and it's going to go on, and it's going to be a siege, then you will see abuse specifically of property rights.
Well, see, this is still going on. Every president since that date has declared an emergency, and that's the continuation of the suspension of the Constitution. And now we have three Patriot Acts. We have now we have the Peace and Prosperity Treaty, which dissolved the United States even, and they're not even talking about it, either candidate, about this. But it stems back to a group of people, back to that era. And the biggie was the Emergency War Powers Act, the Banking Act, and the Farmlands Act.
Well, let me thank you, Gerald, for the thought. Let me ask you, Amity, about that. Who was, Gerald's original point was the Emergency War Powers Act declared war essentially on the people of the United States. That's how he positioned it.
Where I would like him to read that language, please, so that we can hear it if it. Because I am not familiar with war on the people of the United States.
I would suggest everybody read it. You can easily look it up, and don't confuse it with the World War One emergency.
Right. You don't have it in front of you, though.
No,
that's okay. No, but I don't want to concede that until I hear it. We're on the radio, but I've never heard of war on the people of the United States. That sounds improbable.
It does, except, question, if you're declaring war, you have to declare it on somebody or something. So if there's emergency war powers and he's Roosevelt was saying this is like a war, well, who was the war against?
I don't think the war was against anybody. He was just saying, give me the power of an executive in war to do the things I need to do on your behalf. And what the Forgotten Man says is, it forgot that gesture forgot the Forgotten Man and did damage. But it does not say, the book, that it was declaring war upon someone.
Tony is in Texas on Coast to Coast AM for Amity Schlaes. Tony?
Well, thank you, Ian. Great show, guys. I'll try to be brief. I've been doing a lot of research here lately, and a quote by Thomas Jefferson really sticks out in my mind. It seems apropos for the time. I'm going to have to paraphrase it because I don't have it in front of me. He said, if the American people ever let private banks control the issuance of their currency, the American people will end up, or first by inflation, then by deflation, the American people are going to end up homeless on the land that their forefathers conquered. You know, and we've learned that the J.P. Morgan engineered the panic of 1907 to issue in the Federal Reserve Act. And, you know, I heard your guest earlier said something about these guys are panicking. And I was wondering, does that mean that she does not think this is being done by design? Or perhaps she thinks it's being done by design, but they've lost control of it. I don't understand.
Well, that's a good point. Amity?
Well, I just don't follow the – I appreciate the question, and I know that people overstep. I think that J.P. Morgan did pretty much good in 1907. So I differ there. Now, I wouldn't say it's design. I'd say it's chaos. They are reacting to stuff they were not prepared for. There is no – I don't see that kind of planned damage. I see a lot of incompetence and unpreparedness, a lot of distraction, lame duck administration, failure by both parties to get at this Fannie Freddie thing because they were intimidated and they had other stuff on their mind.
Right. Tell me about the idea of planned versus sort of aching for an opportunity, and then when it presents itself saying, aha, here's our chance.
Well, it gets back to our crustacean analogy that I spoke of before. You know, people take advantage sort of viscerally. They just do it when there is an advantage. And when you're under pressure, for example, as Secretary Paulson is, he's going to say, give me lots of power because I don't know what I'm going to do, so I need to at least not worry about that. I need to have control to do it, and that does damage. So is that planned? Is there an intent there? I don't think so. It's just a reaction of humans under stress.
Jennifer is in Elgon, Texas, on Coast to Coast AM for Amity Schlaes. Jennifer?
Good evening. I have a comment, and I would like for your guest to comment on it, if she would, please. Because I believe that the new forgotten man of the last Great Depression is going to be the forgotten woman of this new depression. She will be a baby boomer who is divorced with no children, no family to fall back on. And even if she retrains for a more contemporary job, she will have trouble being hired because of the economic downturn and traditional gender discrimination combined with age discrimination. Even when there was a good job market, it was hard for this demographic to find work. I'm a member of this demographic, and I'm having this problem in Texas, and I've noticed there's a big increase in homeless ladies of this demographic.
Interesting thought.
Pardon?
I said interesting thought.
It's true, sir.
I'm sorry.
Yes, and my point in calling is to see if your guest has encountered examples of this in her research and perhaps in her own career.
Thought on that, Amity?
Wonderful question. It's true that older women have a hard time getting jobs. That's been true forever, and it's wrong. And what's so interesting is William Graham Sumner, who is the man who wrote the first Forgotten Man essay, said the forgotten man is very often a woman. So since the beginning of this theme, which comes from way before Roosevelt, all the way back into the 19th century, C is the forgotten man. He said he used a little algebra with ABC, the one who pays, the one who gets punished in the name of the progressive project. And he said quite explicitly, the forgotten man is often a woman. That's way back in the 19th century he said that. So it's wonderful to hear this from the caller. It's a theme that is true in our country, and we do what we can to help.
But it is, maybe that's the most vulnerable now, is what she's saying, is somebody in her position, maybe true or less true?
Well, I mean, you know, there are all sorts of specific groups that are going to be helped by legislation, but then there are other groups who don't happen to be the beneficiaries of certain projects, and sometimes they end up paying for those projects that are helping some other guy. And yes, often they're women, they're men, they're blacks, they're rich, they're poor. It's always an unintended consequence of some other group being punished for a bad situation.
I think,
are vulnerable groups hurt in downturns? You bet.
I'm sorry it's you, Jennifer, and for other people out
there.
We're
very sorry.
Suffering. Hey, Dave, you get the last thought, but it's got to be real quick for Amity Schlaes.
Okay, Amity, are you familiar with an economist named Ravi Batra?
Yes.
His book, The New Golden Age.
I'm familiar with him, but I wouldn't say I've read all of it.
Okay,
he was the one who warned of depressions years ago,
exactly.
1990. And so.
Read his latest book. There's four fundamental precepts that he recommends: a progressive tax system, a need.
We're going to run out of time here, Dave.
trickle-down economics doesn't work, and supply-side economics doesn't work. We need to have demand, money in the hands of people that will spend it, not the big shots. Read Ravi Batra's book.
Dave will take that as a recommendation in general. And for you, thank you so much, Amity Schlaes. I hope this was enjoyable for you.
Oh, thank you for giving so much time to The Forgotten Man. I think it's a record.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. And that's what the show does well. But I hope on top of that, thank you for being so good with these challenging questions and with all of the different directions that we push guests during those 3 hours. So thank you so much for the spirit that you shared with us, and further success for this book, because I think it's really good to learn from the past and help us avoid the problems in the future.
Oh, thank you so much.
God bless you and your family, and have a lovely time in Hawaii. Coming up next week, though, Brad Steiger, new book. It's awesome. I'll tell you more about it next week. Also, PJ Souls from the Halloween and Carrie movies in the first hour on Coast to Coast. In the meantime, Deus te amat, and I do too.